Hello and welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harpsong for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs by Marguerite Young. Chapter 4. Debs was the son of Jean Daniel Debs, whom everybody called Daniel, and he and the other children called Dandy, and no doubt he seemed to them like the bearded lion who laid down with the lamb, or like the dandelions that were strewn as bright as little yellow suns in the grass. Dandy had been born in Alsace-Lorraine at Colmar, in an ancient, high-shouldered, five-story house in the shadow of the Cathedral of St. Martin. Throughout his life, Debs had wanted to visit the house where his father was born, as he also would have sought to locate the place where Marguerite was born, although it might have been by comparison only a poor stone house, as she was a poor little mill girl, a wage slave before she came to this country in search of happiness. Or so he would sometimes describe her when he was working to help the poor little mill girls and boys who were wage slaves in America. Many of them died of old age and its attendant woes at just about the time when more fortunate children were starting school. Debs's father's father had been an owner of numerous farming interests in textile and grain mills, where Marguerite Betrich had worked as a beater of flax, a spinner of thread, perhaps also as a sifter of grain. Daniel had fallen in love with Marguerite at first glance, perhaps when he saw her with bundles of golden flax under her arm, perhaps when she was in mid-passage of the mill stream, perhaps when she was separating grain from pebbles and sand. His father had opposed the boy's interest in the poor mill girl, as they were not in the same social stream, even if they were in the same mill stream, down by the old red mill. Fortunately, or unfortunately, although the brooding young moon calf had been sent away to school in Paris, in Wildersbach, where he was a student of French poets and romanticists of every stripe, as well as skeptics and deists and agnostics and atheists and revolutionaries by the ton, he had found his love for the little mill girl growing by leaps and bounds and had been unable to give her up for even a moment in his mind. Although the Debs' ancestors at Colmar had been active in the French Revolution, the father was altogether too bourgeois to believe in the equality of all, or that a bridge of love should be built over the abyss dividing the classes. The young man had burned with the revolutionary fires, as with the fires of his love for the little girl, who was forbidden fruit forever beyond his reach, without whom there could be no paradise on earth. Perhaps revolution was always love, love of common humanity, love of the poor. The unyielding mill king was about to yield, or perhaps would have yielded if only there had been a deathbed scene in which he could state that he had had a change of mind, a change of heart, and quite suddenly, without warning, that he was suffering from any ailment of the heart, he had passed away, leaving the son free to marry the poor little fairy-tale goose girl if only she could be persuaded to accept the hand of this persistent lover, whose love would lead her to a distant and largely unknown land from which she and he would never return. They would be able to start life all over again with that part of the estate which was his, and which was greatly reduced by theft even before he sailed. Not Africa, but America, was then the mysterious continent for most Europeans, even as it was for most Americans as to its vast interiors, mountains, rivers, lakes, deserts. Marguerite had feared that in America there might be the injustices that there were in France, and thus perhaps it would be better if the land of which her suitor dreamed remained a land for which he would set sail only in his dreams, as it would be better if he should give up his desire for union with her. Not once had she claimed that his was an unrequited love. She had known that there would be no other love for her, as he had known that there would be no other love for him. She had consented, however, that he should go ahead of her to what he considered to be a more promising world than the old, when in bloody June, 1848, that month, which should be the month of weddings and roses, the revolution had been stamped out by commercial interests, and many revolutionists were driven underground or in flight to foreign lands, especially America, with its vast unpopulated regions, places where a lone horseman might travel all day without seeing any other horseman, unless it was his own shadow on the fog. So I'm also reading, hold on, let me pull up a page in the title. And I just want to do this because I think that this is how things get embedded that really shouldn't be. So by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, I've read a couple of her other books. She has quite a few. I think she read the one about, she did on guns, history of guns in America, which was very interesting. And she has also written All the Real Indians Died Off. And it's exploring the myths we have about the nations and the indigenous people in America. And one of the ones that always comes up, and it's just because I'm not that far. Let me see how far I am. Yeah, I'm only in the first quarter, 25% of the book. But one of the myths she tackles early is the one that America was a wilderness and that there was nobody here. And that's simply not true. The reason the settlers were able to do so much when they got here was because the land had been settled and it had been changed. It was not just this vast wilderness that was, oh, don't get me wrong. I mean, you had, the nations that were here that, had used the land and changed it to fit their purposes. And they were somebody who revered the earth that sustained them and all the systems, all the elements that sustained them. So one of the myths is that, well, you know, they had to come out here and they had to work so hard to clear the land. Ohio's one of them, that they had to work so hard to clear the land and do this, that, and the other. A lot of the nations here were settled. They were not hunter-gatherers. They were farmers, or the farmers, subsistence farmers that also hunted game, of course, but they were settled. They had settlements. And unsure of the population. And because when coming in contact with settlers that spread diseases that they had no natural immunity to, that caused a tremendous amount of turmoil for them. So, yeah, that's a really interesting book. So whenever I see this, I want to point out that, no, this was not a vast wilderness that was just empty of people and, you know, that needed to be filled. This was also the year of the discovery of gold in the creek bed in California, although only the first trickles of gold seekers were coming through from the blasted European lands in which the poor were turning into skeletons. The impetus to a greater migration occurred the following year when the gold dust was confused with the city of gold, which was in the sun and was the place to which had always migrated the souls of the dead, who were fireflies, and gave to the setting sun its glow. Daniel had sailed for America in 1848, but while the four-masted schooner with its disorientating figurehead, perhaps the admiral with a golden cup or the captain's twins or the captain's widow, was still pitching through high storms and heavy winter seas, plowing the waves upon which, unlike those of history, would be left no mark of the plowman. He had been gulled out of a sizable part of his inheritance, the French equivalent of $6,000, by an American confidence man who had represented himself as a successful tobacco speculator with knowledge of a surefire way of getting rich quick. Man, there's just grifters all over. Like there's a profession that is just grifters. And still to this day, my dad just told me of one, he just texted me of one, like, beware, this happened. And I was like, yeah, that's been in the news, Dad. like, don't fall for that. Arriving in New York Harbor on January 20th, 1849, Daniel had turned over almost all the rest of his money to the persuasive confidence man, the master of a magician's disappearing act so complete that he had left no trace and not even a tobacco leaf or a cigar butt for the poor young man to chew on as he thought of the little sweetheart who he was determined must be his bride, for without her he could not live. Not being a tramp used to sleeping on a park bench or in a gutter or in a darkened doorway, Daniel had stayed for a time at the Shakespeare Hotel, which, located at the corner of Duane and William Streets, was frequented by many French and German and were other radicals who were in flight from European capitalistic corruption and were seekers of a new moral world, such as America should be when they had transplanted socialism or communism to this amorphous continent where, as it was imagined, the habits and modes of being in institutions of the past were not so deeply rooted as in the old world, with its furrows cut by habit through so many ages that it resisted change. So what's really interesting is that these people were fleeing to America, socialists, communists, radicals, in other words. But what happened to them, and what you see over and over again, is the grifters. Like, Like they happen all the time. The rabbi community had a grifter that came through and took half the, like hundreds of thousands of dollars and blew through it like in 6 months back at that time. This is a pretty small sum. I just find that amazing that you literally had to have people who were like just going back and forth on a ship, just taking people's money just with these stories and stuff. I don't know. I just find that hilarious. The neighborhood down around City Hall was full of radicals of every breed who seemed permanently amazed by the utopian prospects that seemed to be opening in this millennial land where there were as many folding as opening. There were utopian philosophers of every kind mixing with clowns, politicians, confidence men, rich men such as the Astors and Vanderbilts, who in the lexicons of socialist anarchists, with their dreams of a moneyless, propertyless world, were confidence men who had made good in this age of expansion, which had expressed itself in the Mexican War, and was expressing itself further in the movements of gold rushers, rushing pell-mell not merely to golden rushes growing by silver streams in a paradise which would be beyond this world. There were scriptural communists with secular dreams prompted by mystical origins, and there were followers of Robert Owen, Charles Fourier, Etienne Cabet of the Carians, Brisbaneites, perfectionists who were believers in society's reform, whether immediate as if by sudden transfiguration or remote. When the youthful Walt Whitman, the Brooklyn Eagle, the entire common cosmos, not yet enclosed within him, although it must have been there in an only semi-conscious form, had casually strolled in to cover the world's convention of radical theorists of reform in Clinton Hill, good gracious, in Clinton Hall, New York, he reported under the heading Quixotic Labors. I'm sure that's going like Quixote. On June 6th, Quixotic Labors on June 6, 1846, having noticed that Robert Owen, the philanthropist and human reformer, had arrived again in this republic. Walt Whitman had predicted that in all probability Robert Owen would do no harm, but would also do no good. Whitman had not known whether to laugh at the Convention of World Reformers as a humbug, or commend it as containing the germ of a bold, though fruitless, inquiry into the wrongs and evils of the world. The attendance at the convention had seemed to him, with the exception of the patient and dignified Robert Owen, the last ones who should come forth as reformers of the world. Walt Whitman had found some truth in Robert Owen's speeches and addresses, had listened to two or three of them with much pleasure, and yet was of the opinion that it was utterly chimerical to attempt to remodel the world on an unalloyed basis of purity and perfection. God had not seen fit to do so, and he could hardly expect the thing to be accomplished by Mr. Robert Owen. When Walt Whitman had allowed the ideal of utopia to mull in his mind for a few weeks, as surely it would always mull in his mind whether it was of the future or the past, he was willing to announce under the headline philanthropy that this word signifying the love of man was one of the most beautiful words that our language had inherited from the Greek. It has a musical sound, and the very utterance of it begets pleasant thoughts and inspiring prophecies of good. Perhaps under the spell of Robert Owen as well as Robert... Perhaps under the spell of Robert Owen, as well as Albert Brisbane and others, with their inflated dreams of aligning old age. Oh my gosh. Okay, I just have to get through two more paragraphs and it's the end of the chapter. Okay. I'm tongue-tied. Perhaps under the spell of Robert Owen, as well as Albert Brisbane and others, with their inflated dreams of aligning age-old or newly minted utopias with society's reform, Walt Whitman had seen a vision, however far off, of the relation existing between all men as members of one great family, the duty and pleasure of loving and helping one the other, the dwelling together of the nations in peace as being of the same flesh and blood and bone and bound together by the ties of a common brotherhood. These were the thoughts and feelings that for the good gray poet, not yet the crazy old Walt, who would become as the elegiac author of When Lilacs Laughed and the Dooryard Bloomed, must have lived somewhere in some hearts in the olden time and struggling for existence, had given birth to this beautiful and musical speech. Let us rejoice in its existence and seek to give its divine second birth in action. Phew, sorry about that. I'm beginning to think I'm going to blame it's Young's writing and not my speaking. Trying to read it. Whew, she just has long sentences. We just got done reading about Robert Owen and the Owenites in Angel in the Forest. So if you're interested in that, that's season 104. And cool. These chapters are short. That there's no other way to say it, but they're packed. They've got a lot of stuff going on in them. All right. Thank you for listening. Bye.